John Malkovich got started in the experimental theater group Steppenwolf and went on to star in everything from action films to art films, films like Con Air, In the Line of Fire, Places in the Heart, Dangerous Liaisons, The Sheltering Sky, Of Mice and Men, and of course, Being John Malkovich. He just directed his first feature film, The Dancer Upstairs. It's set in an unnamed Latin American country and follows an honest police detective who's working for a corrupt government. The detective is tracking down an anarchist-turned-terrorist who has thrown the country into chaos. The movie is adapted from the novel by Nicholas Shakespeare. The character of the terrorist is inspired by the leader of the Peruvian group, The Shining Path. Malkovich first read the book after traveling through Peru. I asked him what he'd seen there that connected to The Dancer Upstairs.
I remember the night we got to Lima, I was there with my oldest friend and business partner, Russ Smith. And I remember the night we got to Lima, we were talking to some students, some of whom went to university in America. And in sort of mid-conversation, when they were explaining to us that the Shining Path movement was really just something that happened out in very sort of isolated areas in the countryside, and that it could never arrive in Lima, was the first night Sendero blacked out the city of Lima. And, you know, there were many terrorist acts, security was very, very tight, and obviously, I mean, it was a country in the throes of being buffeted by this revolutionary movement.
You mentioned when you were in Peru that he had blacked out the city of Lima. Now, you do that in the movie, the terrorists black out the city. And in order to do that, I mean, you have a genuine shot of a blackout. You see all the electricity just go off in a flash, which means you had to arrange to do that, and you had to get not only the consent of the mayor or the governor or whoever, but like everyone in the city had to, I suppose, be warned that this was going to happen.
Yes, I think they were warned, but we shot it at a certain time of night when most lights were out already, and they took the electricity out. This was in Porto, in the north of Portugal, for a very, very brief time, and we only did, I think, two takes or something like that. But they were incredibly sort of generous to us, that's true.
Do you have to ask yourself, like, how much is it worth inconveniencing everybody in a city in order to get that shot?
Yeah. Well, you have to ask yourself that just about everything you do, really. Inconveniencing people in the city, as you say, inconveniencing yourself by working 8 years on something. I mean, every day you're faced with certain problems in filmmaking, and one of the problems is you have to deal with real people and their daily lives and their daily needs and all the incredible inconvenience that filmmaking brings. But on the other hand, for the economies of the city and for providing work for people, that can also be quite a boon to a city. So I try to inconvenience people as little as possible, but some sort of hardships can't be avoided, really.
Now, I don't know how self-conscious a person you are, but when you first started making movies after being on stage and you saw yourself blown up for the screen, were you surprised at what you saw, and did it make you any more or less self-conscious?
I'm not a self-conscious person, really. I'm actually a very shy person, quite a timid person. But I'm not self-conscious because I don't think of that person I see in the movies as having anything remotely to do with me. So I watch it usually fairly coldly. If I watch it at all, I watch it quite coldly and quite objectively. But I wouldn't classify myself as among my biggest fans. It's not something I don't at all enjoy, watching myself in a movie, or certainly hearing the sound of my voice really sort of makes me nauseous, in fact. So
That's a lot to overcome if you're an actor. If you don't like seeing yourself and you really hate hearing yourself, and then you're making movies which live forever, I don't know how you cannot be self-conscious when you put it that way.
Well, first of all, I don't see many of them, so that's
right.
a great help
right.
in not sort of making oneself sick. Mm. But it just was never an interest of mine to watch myself. Part of the thing I love about the theater is you had to be there. And there, I think I probably am less self-conscious, or let's just say less self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
The theater is a very different experience than that. And plus, you have the great benefit of the fact that it's a living thing. One either saw it or one didn't. That's all. You can't sort of pop it into a tape machine 30 years later. And also the fact that I don't enjoy watching myself, particularly in movies at all, doesn't mean at all that I don't like acting in movies or don't like the work of acting in movies.
Right.
I actually like the work itself. The work itself interests me.
Mm-hmm.
But if one could compare it to what you do, I doubt you sit and listen to the interviews you do with people every night, right? You do your interviews. It's the work you like.
Right, I understand what you mean. I mean, I feel I have a quotient of how much of my own interviews I can listen to without surpassing what I can handle.
What you can bear.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You see, me, I've made 60 films. I get it. You know,
right.
I get
right.
it. Okay. But I have to go on doing my work. And there are many other actors I would just much prefer watching mm-hmm. to watching myself.
I think the first movie that I saw you in which you played the heavy was in The Line of Fire, which you starred in with Clint Eastwood. And you play a presidential assassin who's ready to kill a president again.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about this movie is that, you know, both you
and... I should point out, excuse me, that actually the character isn't the person who shot the president the first time. He that character sort of tortured Clint Eastwood with his own failure to protect the president. But it actually, in my memory anyway...
I'll go with
your
memory.
He actually hadn't assassinated the... At this point, President Kennedy, I suppose it was.
Right, okay, good.
Yeah. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, what I was going to say is that one of the interesting things here is that, you know, Clint Eastwood has this, like, small voice in movies. And the voice that you use as this potential killer who's, you know, threatening the life of the president and threatening Clint Eastwood, the Secret Service agent as well, you speak in this very kind of quiet, meticulous, slightly cranky voice. So so the two of you are speaking.
mm-hmm.
You're both very powerful people, and you're speaking in these little voices.
Well, I never realized I was cranky. I always thought it was rather good-natured. But I've always been quiet, and that's always been the way I've spoken or communicated. I don't like loud noise. I don't like loud sounds. And I got along with Clint very well because he, too, is really quiet. I think he's actually quieter than I am. And he's also quite shy, actually. But I think a lot of people, obviously, who might prove to be on some level dangerous in life or capable of communicating danger are not necessarily people who shout the loudest.
Right. Well, let's hear a scene. Let's hear a scene from the film in which you're on the phone with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Trying to trace me, Frank.
Now, why didn't I think of that?
You did. Are you not the adversary I'd hoped for? Speaking of which, how are you? I was worried about you today.
Huh? Why?
In the motor game. I thought you were going to pass out. You really should get in shape for that kind of duty.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
By the way, I'm watching your movie.
Movie?
November 1963, Kennedy's last days, the arrival in Texas. It must have been exciting for you, Frank. Dallas, that morning at Love Field. You all look so radiant. JFK, Jackie, and you. You look so young and able, Frank. What did happen to you that day? Only one agent reacted to the gunfire, and you were closer to Kennedy than he was. You must have looked up at the window of the Texas Book Depository, but you didn't react. Late at night, when the demons come, do you see the rifle coming out of that window, or do you see Kennedy's head being blown apart? If you'd reacted to that first shot, could you have gotten there in time to stop the big bullet? And if you had, that could have been your head being blown apart. Do you wish you'd succeeded, Frank? Or is life too precious?
That's Clint Eastwood and my guest John Malkovich in a scene from In the Line of Fire. John Malkovich, I missed the movie Con Air, in which you played the heavy. Did you do a voice that's very different from the one we just heard in The Line of Fire?
I actually don't know. I've never seen Con Air.
Oh, and then we have something in common.
Yes, yeah, we certainly do. I never saw Con Air. I've heard so much about it, but I never saw it.
You weren't
and
curious?
I have no idea. Not terribly. I had a basic understanding of what was being made. There are some things I'm curious about. I'm curious, yes, to sort of see how Simon West cut it together and the other things that were filmed that I wasn't really privy to. And there are a couple of performances in it from people I met on that film or work with on that film that I'd be happy to check out. But it was just never around when I was around. And I'm not a huge moviegoer at all, so...
Did you surprise yourself being cast as the heavy in a blockbuster film?
No. It's really, you can't just do sort of Portuguese art films.
right.
And make a living, which I do with some regularity. You also have to literally make your living, you know. Doing Con Air is how I paid for the option of The Dancer Upstairs. It's how I paid for the screenplay, and how we ran our little production office and
right.
all of that. And without that, in fact, Jerry Bruckheimer produced Con Air, and for a long time we thought of calling our production company, which is called Mr. Mudd, of naming it Jerry's Kids instead, because he'd really paid for it.
That's funny.
And, you know, I have no problem doing that, or no problem also being in something popular, but in the end, an actor, you choose from that, from among those things that you've been offered.
Exactly, right. Let me ask you about one of the things that you were offered.
Mm-hmm.
One of the movies that you starred in was Being John Malkovich, in which people mm-hmm. could spend a few minutes inside your head and see what it was like to be you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so here you are playing John Malkovich, but the John Malkovich you were playing, I'm sure, is not the John Malkovich who you really are. So mm-hmm. Who did you base the character on?
Well, you know, I never really took it as anything to do with me. I mean, except I thought the jokes about me were really terrific jokes and very funny and very sort of cruel and altogether on target and completely to be fully embraced. But I do remember the first few times in rehearsal or shooting of that, when Spike Jonze, you know, who's a very young man who directed Being John Malkovich, would say to me, Malkovich wouldn't do it that way. And I would say, oh, really? Oh, well, how would Malkovich do it? I mean, I don't know. And he would say, well, he'd do it like this. Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, thanks. I'm glad to find out how Malkovich would do it. And I suppose it was sort of strange, but the only thing I really thought about with that film was that I had always been allowed to be at least a semi-public person who was left to have a private life and really pretty much left alone by the media and the public. And I had a really deep appreciation and thankfulness for that, that I didn't want to see changed by doing this film that's called Being John Malkovich, that's supposedly about this person that's called John Malkovich. But in fact, that didn't happen. It didn't change my life in any way, or, and I'm very lucky. And that was the only thing I really thought about John Malkovich, is I don't want to sort of cross the line into a sort of, I don't know, rent-a-celeb.
Right.
And
well, you know, the image of the actor in there. Like, there's one part where you're doing a reading from a text into the tape recorder, and you're reading, I am hungry as the winter. I am sick, anxious, poor as a beggar. Fate has tossed me hither and thither. And it's all quite pretentious. So the image of the actor in the film is a spoiled, pretentious, self-absorbed, but at the same time kind of an empty vessel.
Yeah.
So what did you think of that image as the actor that you were embodying in the film?
First of all, I think all that's true, certainly about me. I mean, pretentious, self-absorbed, et cetera, et cetera. It is probably about many actors. It is, by the way, true of many people also. But that's what I like in that way. Yes, I have my own personality. I have my own life. I have my own friends. I have the things I like to do. But as an actor, I think you are an empty vessel. That's really what you are. You see, it's not about me. I'm nothing. Nothing at all. and without sounding like a sort of 60s person, you really are an empty vessel. It's not important at all who I am or what I am or who I am, who I'm not or what I'm not. It's, to me, the work is all there is. And I think that film very beautifully illustrates that I'm of no interest otherwise. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think that's a fantastic message in that film. And I love to have been able to be at least one of the messengers of that message.
Well, John Malkovich, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. It was time well spent for me. Thank you very much.
John Malkovich. Here's a scene from Being John Malkovich after Malkovich has entered the portal to his own brain and then been ejected. Waiting for him is the man who discovered the portal, played by John Cusack.
That was no simulation!
I know, I'm sorry.
It's such an honor. I have been to the dark side. I have seen a world that no man should see.
Really, for most people, it was a rather pleasant experience. I mean,
that portal is mine, and it must be sealed forever for the love of God.
But, Mr. Malkovich, sir, with all due respect, I discovered that portal. I mean, it's my livelihood, do you understand?
It's my head, Schwartz! It's my head! I will see you in court!
What makes you think I won't be seeing what you're seeing in court?
John Malkovich just directed his first film, The Dancer Upstairs.